start with probably the first topic in the Sedra, is the place of the Sedra itself in the chronology of the history of Klal Yisrael. This is one of the classic cases of Ein Mukdam U'Me'ucher BaTorah. Clearly, Torah starts out at the beginning of this week's Sedra, the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, that the events that are recorded are Be'echad L'Chodesh Hasheni Bashona Hashenis, the first day of the second month of the second year from they went out of Mitzrayim, which means Rosh Chodesh Iyar. And in the middle of Parshas Noso, week from this Shabbos Sedra, the next Sedra, in the middle, it speaks about the day that the Mishkan was consecrated, which was Rosh Chodesh Nisan of the second year, the beginning of the first month of the second year. So the events that happened in next week's Sedra preceded the events that happened in this week's Sedra by a month. So from here we learn Ein Mukdam U'Me'ucher BaTorah, that the Torah does not necessarily follow a chronological order. That's the cloud. However, that doesn't mean that the Torah just arbitrarily doesn't follow chronology. Usually, the Torah follows the events as they happen chronologically. Unless there's a reason why the Ribbono Shel Olam felt that the message that would be given out not following the chronological order was more important than the chronological order. In other words, normally the Torah goes in the historical order of the things that happen. But if there's a reason why not, then the Torah doesn't necessarily follow the chronological order if there's a good reason why not to. So that leaves us with the following. Here it's clear that the Torah did not follow the chronological order, that what's recorded is clearly happened. This Sedra happened after the next Sedra. The Torah says it. It's not even something that we deduce from anything. Here the Torah says the events happened on the beginning of the second month of the second year, and next week it says the events happened the beginning of the first month of the second year. So now the question is, why? Why does the Torah tell us about the events of the second month before it tells us about the events of the first month? So let's first discuss what those events were. The event of the second month was the consecration of the Mishkan. The Mishkan was consecrated on Rosh Chodesh Nisan of the second year after they left Mitzrayim. On that day, the Shechinah devolved into the Mishkan, and on that day, the Nesiim started bringing their korbanos, one per day, for the next 12 days. That is what's recorded in next week's Sedra. In this week's Sedra, the Mishkan is already consecrated, and the Shechinah has already devolved into it, and Bnei Yisrael are set up around the Mishkan. The Leviim are separated, and the entire living pattern of Klal Yisrael around the Mishkan, with their degolim, each one with their flag, and their specific place to be, that is what's recorded in this week's Sedra. So I think that the lesson, or at least perhaps one of the lessons, is very simple. And that is, we could have the following question. The Ribbono Shel Olam wanted us to build a Mishkan so he could put his presence amongst us. Okay? And the Jewish people then dwelt around the Mishkan, with the Mishkan as the focal point of their living, which was the ikkar and which was the tachlis. What was the tachlis and what was the means to reach that tachlis? One way is the tachlis of everything was God's presence being in this world. In order for God's presence to be in this world, the Jewish people had to dwell around the Mishkan and had to have the Levim take care of the Mishkan or whatever, but the tachlis was that God's presence should be here. Or no, the tachlis was that the Jewish people should dwell around the Mishkan, around God's presence. And in order for that to happen, God's presence had to devolve into the Mishkan. Was the Mishkan the goal, or was B'nai Israel the goal? We have a rule, Sof Maaseh, the Machshava Tchila, that when the Torah, when the Torah records things, it records the means, it records the goal before, many times it records the goal before the means. In other words, first it tells us what the tachlis is, and then it tells us how that tachlis was reached. And then the Torah goes out of chronological order. Because obviously, the tachlis comes after the means to reach it. But the Torah wants to impress us what is the main thing. What's the goal over here? And therefore, over here, the Torah said the following. The goal of God's presence being in the Mishkan is not that God's presence should be in the Mishkan, but that in order for Klal Yisrael to be able to center their entire lives around HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God's presence had to be in a Mishkan that they would dwell around. So the tachlis was that Klal Yisrael should dwell around the Mishkan. But the means to do that was the consecration of the Mishkan or whatever. Therefore, the Torah first told us the tachlis. The tachlis was that Klal Yisrael should dwell and make the Shechinah their focal point of their life. That was the purpose. And in order to do that, God had to devolve into the Mishkan. His presence had to devolve into the Mishkan. And it's clear from how God prefaces the building of the Mishkan. The Asuli Mikdash, the Shachanti Bissocham. Not Bissocho. Make me a Mishkan so I can dwell in it. No. Make me a Mishkan so I can dwell amongst the Jewish people. The purpose is not the Mishkan. The purpose of the Mishkan is that Klal Yisrael should have something that represents God's presence to dwell around. The Shachanti Bissocham, not Bissocho. Yes. Where else do we see that? I'll give you another example, and it's my own court, so I can't. It says, Shomar v'zochor b'dibur echad nemru. Right? But in fact, in the Torah, the zochor comes before the shomar. Zochor is in Yisro, and shomar is in Voeschana. So why is it shomar v'zochor b'dibur echad? It should have been zochor v'shomar. But the idea is that the goal is the zochor. The remembrance of Shabbos. Shabbos is like Olam Haba. The means to reach that is the Shomer, is the observance of Shabbos. But therefore, the Zohar was mentioned first, because that's the goal, and the way to reach that goal was mentioned second. But in actual practice, the means comes before the goal. Okay. So that is one explanation of why the Sedra of Bamidbar precedes the Sedra of Naso, even though what happened, at least in the end of Naso, happened before the events that happened in Bamidbar. Okay. What is the idea of these Degolim? It says that when Klal Yisrael got the Torah and they saw the angels who had, yeah. You can do whatever you want, yeah. I'm not opposed to having air conditioning. But you close the windows if you turn on the air conditioning. Did it go on, or is it a very silent air conditioner? It's on? Okay. Psychologically, it's colder if it seems like it's on. Okay. Okay, that sounds like it's on. Okay, it says that when Klal Yisrael, HaKadosh Baruch Hu came with the Malachim on Har Sinai to give the Torah, so the Malachim themselves are arranged according to Degolim. There's the Degel of Michael and the Degel of Gabriel. Each angel has his subordinate angels with a flag. They have their own color and their own picture or whatever, just like Klal Yisrael had. The idea being, every degel represents, first of all, in an army, every platoon or whatever has its banner. It represents the fact that they all represent the fact that we are in the same army, fighting for the same cause, united under the same king, but each serves a little bit different purpose. Each one has a little bit different expertise. There's the Army and the Navy and the Air Force, and in each of those, there are different groups that serve different sub-purposes within them. And the color of the flag, and the picture on the flag, and the wording on the flag represents the unique individuality of each group. Yaakov Kamenetsky points out that when it came to Har Sinai, they didn't dwell according to Degolim. This Shevet was here and this Shevet was there. Everybody was Ke'ish Echad, B'Lev Echad. They dwelt intermixed altogether. It's only after the Torah was given and the Mishkan was consecrated that they split into tribes, each tribe his place to dwell. Each one had its specific flag. The groups of the tribes, three tribes together, existed. All that didn't exist before the Mishkan was put up. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says the following. In order for people to be able to exhibit and utilize their unique talents, they first have to have something that unites them so they don't become disjointed and just separate people. They have to have something that unites them all so they don't become separated by their uniqueness and individuality. So until the Torah was given, and then it descended into the Mishkan, and God's presence was there, and the Jewish people had something to unify around, they couldn't really express their individuality, because the danger of expressing your individuality is that it breaks up the unity. But once they had something that gave them a unity, they had something as a focal point to unify them all, then it was very positive that in that unity, everyone had their unique place. Everybody in Yiddishkeit, there has to be conformity. There are certain principles, certain ideas, certain beliefs, certain practices that we all have to do equally. Men, women, children, right, everybody. But once you have those things that unite us all uniformly, conforming to all those things, all of us, then everybody can have those areas where they are unique. And everybody has their specific mitzvahs. Men, their specific mitzvahs. Women, their specific mitzvahs. Kohanim, Leviim, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, and so on. Every person, his unique talents, abilities, capabilities, and those unique mitzvahs that apply to him, which don't apply to other people. For instance, farmers have certain mitzvahs that city dwellers don't have. And factory workers have certain mitzvahs that farmers don't have. And so on. And each individual tatkid adds to the shleimus of the whole. But if you don't have the shleimus of the whole as an underlying principle, then the individuality breaks up the achdus, and every man for himself. or every woman for herself. So therefore, first, said Rabbi Yaakov, you had to have the Mishkan as a unifying factor before you could break up into degolim and everybody have their specific color and their specific flag and their specific picture, which means their specific talents, abilities, capabilities, and tafkid and mission in this world. And therefore, the purpose of the Mishkan was to enable Klal Yisrael to dwell around it and to express their individuality. That's the goal. But in order to reach that goal, the means to do it was that God's presence had to devolve into the Mishkan. But not that the goal was that God's presence should devolve into the Mishkan. Okay. Any questions on that? We'll go to another email. The the next thing is Bamidbar. The Torah was given in a Midbar. So the Medrash points out that the Torah was given in three mediums. Some Midrashim seem to say that the Torah is compared to three different things: Midbar, Eish, and Mayim. Torah is compared to fire, water, and a desert. So, what is the idea of this? So one idea I was thinking of is the following. The Torah itself is like fire. How so? Fire has many functions to it. And the functions of Torah, the external functions of Torah, are similar to the functions of fire. What are the functions of fire? Fire gives light. The external function of Torah is to enlighten a person, to teach him what the mitzvahs are. Simply. If you don't know what the mitzvahs are, you can't do them. So you have to learn Torah in order to do Ratzon Hashem. So Torah is a vehicle to be able to do Ratzon Hashem, and therefore it's an enlightening process, like fire lights up and enables a person to see things that he wouldn't see without the fire. Fire provides light. The second thing is, fire creates heat. Torah is supposed to arouse a person's emotions. Musar, his orerus, that also comes from Torah. Torah is a vehicle not just of intellectual enlightenment, but emotional arousal. Torah is supposed to arouse your emotions. Thirdly, fire is a kli, it's a means for creating creativity, both in food. It enables people to cook their food and have food that is more processed and better. It also enables people to have industry. In order to make things industrially, you need fire for most things. Right? Fire melts, and fire is the vehicle for being creative. Similarly, Torah is the kli that we use to utilize and use the world properly. How we utilize the world through Torah, through mitzvahs, through learning Torah, right, processes and perfects the world. We use the things in the world using Torah as the medium to perfect them, to use them properly, to make out of them what God intended as the raw materials, to take those raw materials and to utilize them and use them to their perfection. So in that respect, Torah is also like fire. And lastly, fire burns. Now, fire can burn negative things. You can burn away things that are negative, get rid of them. And in that respect, the Torah burns away the Yetzer Hara. Barasi Yetzer Hara, Barasi Torah Tavlin. In that respect, the Torah is a Sam HaChayim. It's an elixir of life because it burns away, destroys the negatives of life, and enables life to emerge unscathed. On the other hand, Torah also can be like fire and burn good things and destroy good things and only leave ashes, only leave destruction in its course. If Torah is not learned properly, then the Torah itself becomes a sam hamavis. It becomes a poison, worse than not learning. Learning without the intention of observing, learning to show other people up, using the Torah in the totally opposite function that it's supposed to have, totally shelo lishma, not just for ulterior motives, but for negative motives, the Torah itself is a destructive fire. It's a sam hamavis. The Vilna Gaon says that there's another marshal. Torah is like water. If you water poison weeds, you get more poison weeds. If you water beautiful plants, you get more beautiful plants. Depends what you planted. If you have planted within you poisonous weeds, then the Torah will make those poisonous weeds flourish. And if you planted within you beautiful, productive, positive plants, the Torah will make those flourish. So the Torah can be a sam hamavis or a sam hachayim. We're using the same allegory as Torah being fire. Fire can burn away negative and leave very positive things, or fire can burn away the positive and leave destruction. So those are the ideas of how Torah is compared to fire. But that basically deals with how Torah affects you on the outside, the way you use the Torah for various effects. Then the Torah is compared to water, because Torah has a pnimius. It has a very inner aspect to it. Not how you use the Torah, but what the Torah does to you. Water basically goes within you. And it goes within you by drinking it and keeping you alive. It is the source of life, the foundation of life, water, through drinking. It also washes you on the outside, but the washing on the outside seeps into the inside and also cleanses your pores, cleanses your skin. It's not just an external cleansing, it's an internal cleansing too. And therefore, cleansing with water also has a spiritual effect in a mikveh. The water has an inner spiritual cleansing, not just a physical hygienic cleansing. So water is the Torah in its inner state. Fire is the Torah in how you use it pretty much externally, for its external purposes. Whereas water is the aspect of Torah that Torah is life itself. And water is the mainstay of life. In that respect, Torah gives a person the basis of life, which is like water, ingesting water, and it also purifies him, and it makes him a better person. Learning Torah, it purifies his midos by washing away the negatives that a person has and being absorbed into the person's pores, his spiritual pores, and giving him that tahara, that purity of water. So those are the aspects of Torah being compared to fire and being compared to water. But the Torah was given in a midbar. That's not the Torah is like a midbar. The Torah, the place of the Torah is like a midbar. The place where you find Torah is like a midbar. Now comes the interesting thing. In a midbar, there is not too many trees growing where you could make a fire, and their water is rare to find. By an oasis, you can find water in the desert, but it's rare. There aren't a midbar means that there's not readily available water supply. That is the mitzias of a midbar, right? So it's interesting. Torah is compared to fire, and Torah is compared to water, but it was given in a place where fire and water are scarce, where it's hard to have fuel for a fire, and it's hard to find water. interesting observation, I think. And therefore, what's the lesson from that? That you're not going to get the Torah on a silver platter. You're going to have to work for it. You're going to have to look for the wood and gather it and bring it perhaps even from somewhere else. It's not going to come to you. The fire of Torah, if you want to produce that fire, you're going to find that the Torah was given in a midbar, which necessitates hard work, which necessitates you to look around and find the means to make that fire. Yogati umatsasi tamin. Somebody tells you they put in effort and they found results in Torah, believe them. But lo yogati umatsasi al tamin. But if somebody tells you they didn't put in effort and they got results, doesn't work by Torah. Torah is not going to be given to you on a silver platter. Torah is something you have to work for. Both the fire of Torah and the water of Torah. You're going to have to search for that water, dig deep in the desert, find an oasis. But you're not going to have it readily available to you. And you're not going to have the source of the fuel for the fire readily available. That's why the Torah is given the midbar. Exactly because the Torah is compared to fire and water, and fire and water are both scarce in the midbar. Which, something I think I've mentioned before, I'll mention again, especially after Lag BaOmer, and having to listen to the radio with these announcements or whatever, ad nauseum. We live in a world where what I just told you is not understood. Just the opposite. The feeling of people, I'm talking about frum people. Surely not frum people. But even frum people. Even very frum people. I saw about 2 years ago that the Israeli orange growers have developed a new genetically engineered orange, which I think is on the market already. The article said that they invested millions of dollars in this new orange. And they were asked, like, what was wrong with the old orange that you had to invest millions of dollars to engineer genetically a new orange? So they said the following. They said the new orange is genetically engineered to have a thin skin and no pits. He said, people today, the spokesman for the orange industry said, the people today want things fast and easy. They want an orange that's fast to peel and easy to eat without pits. And we have to provide our clientele with what they want or we'll go out of business. Now, when it comes to oranges, that may be okay. But it spills over to every aspect of life. People want things fast and easy. Right? And they don't want to put effort into something. They don't want things to take time. They want it now, fast. And they don't want it to involve any kind of effort. The faster, the easier, the better it is. And that spills over into regular life for many people. Right? I want marriage fast and easy, meaning I want a marriage where there's no problems, don't have to work on anything. I want children fast and easy, meaning I don't want to have to raise them with any kind of difficulty or whatever. I just want perfect children that give me no problems and are just a tremendous pride that I can take pride in them. And maybe they should raise themselves because I don't want to put any effort into them. And I want it to be fast and easy. And what happens then? That this world is not a place where anything happens fast and easy. So there are problems in marriage and there are problems in raising children. And people who only are interested in fast and easy don't want to get involved. So what do? Either they ignore their children, or worse, they abandon their children. Sometimes they abandon them physically, and sometimes just spiritually and emotionally or whatever. And people are getting divorced like that's part of marriage. In fact, now, by some people, the custom is that before they get married, they already sign a prenuptial agreement of how they're going to divide everything up when they get divorced. Somebody told me people don't get marriage licenses anymore. They get learner's permits. Nobody's willing to commit themselves to anything, right? To put in some work or whatever. No situation is problem-free. It doesn't exist in this world. Every situation, that's what this world is all about. Dealing with problems, solving them. Accommodating oneself to them, coping with them. That's what the world is all about. That's what you're here for. There's no situation that's problemless. There's no job that doesn't have problems. There's no marriage that doesn't have problems. There's no raising of children that is not without problems, and so on and so on. There's no place you can live that doesn't have an upside and a downside. But that's what life is all about. It's not oranges. It's not a bowl of cherries either, but it's not a bowl of oranges that are easy and fast. But that's what people want, and they want it in Torah too. You know, it's coming now to Erev Rosh Chodesh Sivan soon, another week and a half, whatever. There is a special tefillah, which you'll be aware of when you get married and have children in Mirz Hashem, special tefillah for parents to say Erev Rosh Chodesh Sivan, that was composed by the Shaloh HaKadosh. Right? Very important. Tefillah, Shaloh HaKadosh was not somebody, you know, Stam, somebody. He was the Shaloh HaKadosh. So his tefillah is pretty powerful. And that tefillah is a tefillah that your children should be B'nai Torah and B'nos Torah, Yirei Shemayim. And that's a very popular thing. I mean, every year I know that in my Kehillah, people are downloading the tefillah that is translated into English by Art Scroll, so they really know what it says. It's a long tefillah, and it's a lot of hard words. So many of the people download it, and they can be able to say it, and at least know what it says in English, or even say it in English. And all these families are really gung-ho about saying this tefillah. Now, there's nothing wrong with saying this tefillah. But anybody who thinks that is how you're going to guarantee to have children who are B'nai Torah and B'nos Torah and Yirei Shemayim is by saying a tefillah once a year from the Shaloh HaKadosh as a skula, has to have his head examined. Educating children and bringing them properly is not saying a tefillah once a year. That's a skula. I always like to compare a skula to the icing on the cake. If you have the cake, the icing makes the cake very delicious. But if you don't have any cake and only icing, it is very not delicious and it is very unhealthy. People today don't want the cake, they just want the icing. They just want the schools. To the point where last year, I saw it really got me upset. There was an announcement made that since this tefillah is a nice long tefillah and it's difficult, if you'll send in $18 to this organization, they'll have people say the tefillah for you. Now that's surely going to guarantee you to have children who are tzaddikim, having somebody else say a tefillah once a year for you. And Lag BaOmer, it's unbelievable what people will believe about what Torah is in place of putting effort into making what Torah really is. I heard on the radio last year, maybe here in Israel, one of the religious stations, that if you give a certain amount of money to a tzedakah that deals with handicapped children with handicaps, then Reb Chaim Kanievsky guarantees that you will never have a handicapped child. Now that's pretty good, because God doesn't guarantee it. Now, I have nothing against Reb Chaim. Chaim's a tzaddik. I'm not one. I guarantee that Reb Chaim didn't say it. No way that he said it. But that's what they quoted. I guarantee you that Reb Chaim didn't say it. There's no shaila in my mind. I don't have to ask him. There's no way he could say that. Only an idiot could have said that, and Reb Chaim is definitely not an idiot. He's a tremendous Talmud Chacham and a tremendous Tzaddik. He's definitely not an idiot. But only an idiot could have said that. But that's what people want. They don't want to have to work on out problems, and sometimes things are terrible problems in this world. Very difficult situations in the Sionos to cope with. Rahman Litzlan, a person has to bring up a handicapped child or a Down syndrome child. It's not easy. It happens in this world. It even happens to tzaddikim, where people don't have children, or people have children that are worse than not having children. So that's what the world is all about. But it's not give $18 to this tzedakah and you're guaranteed an easy time. That's the skula. Or yesterday, constantly, right? Or Rashbi, as if Rav Shimon bar Yochai is some god. Rav Shimon bar Yochai was a tana, was a tzaddik. But believe in Rav Shimon bar Yochai, and he will. And they said, give the money, and we won't let Rav Shimon bar Yochai turn away your tefillas. The Rambam says you're not allowed to daven to anything except the Ribbono Shel Olam. Surely not Rav Shimon bar Yochai. And when you daven to the Ribbono Shel Olam, there's no guarantees. Because God doesn't always answer our prayers the way we want. But Rav Shimon bar Yochai, from the scene from the radio, definitely answers your prayers and guarantees you results all the time. So I would rather serve Rav Shimon bar Yochai than the Ribbono Shel Olam, except that's Avodah Zarah. So Yiddishkeit has become a bunch of schoolers. Right? Paraphrasing Rabbi Wein once said, it's a shame that Lo Signov is not a minig, because then people may keep it. It's too bad it's part of the Aseres HaDibros, not the steal. I say differently. It's too bad Lo Signov isn't a schooler, because then people will keep it. Schoolers, everybody wants. Mitzvahs, learning, putting effort into things, not interested. I want a schooler. Fast, easy, don't bother me with any bother. And that's not the way it is. The Torah is fire and the Torah is water. But you're not going to have it easy. You're going to have to go into a midbar to get the Torah where there's no fire and no water unless you put an effort to get it. I think that's the lesson. Okay. Another idea is, it's another Medrash says that the Torah was given in a midbar, that a person has to make himself like a midbar to receive the Torah. Now, what does that mean? So I think it has a few different connotations. One is being hefker like a midbar means that you don't depend on the luxuries of this world. You don't become dependent on them. You can have luxury. You don't have to run away from luxury in this world and live a life of dire poverty and asceticism, where you're poreish from everything in the world. It's not the goal, necessarily. And even though the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Kachi Darka Shel Torah, Pas B'melech Tocha, Al Mayim B'Mesura Tishteh, V'Al Ha'oretz Tishon, V'Chayetzar Tichya, this is the Derech HaTorah, eat bread and salt, nothing more. Don't drink anything but water. And sleep on the floor, don't sleep in a bed. And live a life of privation and suffering. Uvetorah ta'amel. And if you then put your effort into Torah, Ashrecha v'tovlach, you'll be fortunate, it'll be good for you. Ashrecha b'olam hazeh v'tovlach olam haba. You'll be fortunate in this world, it's good for you in the next world. First of all, I understand why it's good for you in the next world. Why are you fortunate in this world and a life like that? Secondly, does that really mean that all of us are not the Derech HaTorah? I mean, before I came here, I had some soda. So that's it. I'm out of the Derech HaTorah for sure, because I drank more than water. And I ate for lunch more than bread and salt. And I sleep in a bed. So that's it. I'm really far from Derech HaTorah on every account. And I would assume that all of you, if not most of you, also fall into that category. In fact, every Gadol b'Yisrael that I knew slept in a bed. I don't know what they ate, but I know they slept in beds. So they're out of the going for Torah also. The only person I ever knew that slept on the floor was an old aunt of mine who had back trouble. She used to sleep on the floor. Remember, it made a big impression on me, right? Because she couldn't sleep in a bed. Her back, she needed to sleep on the hard floor. So she probably was the only person I ever knew, but Derech HaTorah, because she didn't sleep in a bed. Is that what it means? The answer is, what it means is something different completely. What it means is the following. You can eat steak and drink champagne and sleep on a Sealy mattress and have a very luxurious life. What would, however, be if those things were taken away from you, but you still were able to lead a Torah life? How would you feel? Would you feel miserable that your life is worthless? Then what you are in this world for are those things, and since those things are taken away from you, you feel you have no purpose to live, even though you're able to observe the Torah. But that's not what gives you your fortunate feeling in this world. It's those other things that did. And you're not the Derech HaTorah. But if you could live an existence and have to eat bread and salt and only drink water and sleep on the floor and live a life of privation, but uvetorah atomel, you could still be involved with Torah, and you would feel imatoseke nashrecha v'tovla. If you do that, you could do that and still feel fortunate, then you know that you're on the Derech HaTorah. Because then what's the ikkar in your life is Torah. Those other things are merely enhancements to your Torah life. But the ikkar of your life is Torah. That's not the ikkar of your life. How do you know? How do you feel if those things aren't there, but Torah is there? Do you feel fortunate still, or do you feel totally miserable? If you feel totally miserable and the Torah means nothing to you, Torah is not what gives you good feeling and fortune in this world, then you know you're not the Derech HaTorah. That's what it means. And therefore, the person has to be like an amidbar, to make himself hefker, not be dependent on things in this world. You can have them. You can enjoy them. You can use them as an enhancement for your Torah life. Living in a nice house, right, is an enhancement to be able to serve the Rabbanu Shlom better. You can have hachnasas orchim, and you can feel much better about yourself. And if you sleep in a good bed, so you can wake up early in the morning and daven nicely and learn okay and be nice and give tzedakah and do chesed because you're not grumpy or whatever because you didn't sleep all night. All of those things can be used in a very positive enhancement for your Torah life. But if you're dependent on them, and that is what your life depends on, then you're out of the Torah ballpark. So that's the first thing of a midbar. Second thing of a midbar is that you can't have preconceived notions. You have to let the Torah mold your thinking and your ideas and not try to force your preconceived ideas into the Torah. Just like a midbar is hefker. A midbar is someplace where nobody is ruling. Whatever is in there, that's what rules. The Torah rules you. You don't rule the Torah. The Torah molds your opinions. Your opinions don't mold the Torah. And what else? And also that in the midbar you can't rely on anything, because nothing to rely on except the Rabbanu Shalom. So when it comes to Torah also, you can only rely on the Rabbanu Shalom and no one else and nothing else. So that's another idea of why the Torah was given in a midbar, not because it's compared to the place, but that the person has to make himself like a midbar to be able to receive Torah. Okay.